Guest Snyder, Paul, and Philip Collins. They co-wrote The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an examination of the epistemic autocracy from the 19th century to the 21st century. Basically, oh, actually, I got this summation from Amazon, which I thought was pretty good. It's a story of how the criminal elite hijacked science and transformed it into a weapon against the masses. I thought that was a pretty pithy summation. How are you all doing tonight?
Oh, not bad. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you. Thank you both for coming on tonight. What we want to talk about tonight is a very long article you wrote a few years ago. It's called Destabilization, Directed Discontent in Egypt and Beyond. You wrote it in March of 2011. I read it at Conspiracy Archive, which is a website that kind of dedicates itself to analyzing secret societies, cryptocracy, and deep politics. That's conspiracyarchive.com, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
Is that where most of your work is posted now?
That's where most of it is. Yeah, we had an ongoing relationship with Terry Melanson. Terry Melanson, by the way, has written a book called Perfectibilist, which is probably the best book, the quintessential book, over the Bavarian Illuminati and how it acted as kind of the shock troops of the Enlightenment. And it avoids – and it relies – on mostly primary sources, but also on some very dependable secondary sources, and stays away. It just cuts away all of the sensationalism that has built up around this group and around this topic for many, many years.
Yes, Terry Melanson is the one who maintains and established the Conspiracy Archive, and he graciously, for many years, has provided us with a platform at that particular online venue.
So he doesn't blame Jesuits and Coneheads for everything?
No.
yeah, I think I've read a few of his pieces. Maybe, was it Christopher Mannion? Is that a name?
Banyan.
Yeah. He's written some good stuff there, too, regarding their influence of the Rockefellers, and he gets into the weeds of this stuff. So it is an excellent website. And it gets into detail, and it does help you navigate, this minefield we call, alternative news or information or truth community or whatever you want to call it. It is a great website.
We like to think of it as kind of an elevated form of criminology.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, because you do have to take sort of a criminologist approach to elite deviancy and how they rule, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem is that a lot of criminology nowadays is pointed towards bottom feeders. And the whole idea of deviancy among the elite class is seldom broached. And that's what we've tried to do with our work because it's a reality. It's a reality that the elite class and those who inhabit the hallowed halls of officialdom and not all of them, but some of them do engage in deviant and criminal activity. And it has to be, it's a topic that needs to be explored and examined because you're talking about people now who exert an influence on the broader civilization.
And you could say their deviancy is a function of their elite status.
Yes.
Because they're removed from normal, it's a breakaway civilization type thing where they're removed from the everyday concerns and anxieties of life, and they think they've transcended morality.
Right? Yeah, when you become an insular clique like that, you end up cultivating a cold indifference.
Right. The socioeconomic disparities that accompany occupying a higher tier of society, a higher socioeconomic tier, tends to propagate a particular pathology that can be, in most cases, very unhealthy. And in our work, we demonstrate this. It actually results ultimately in the engendering of a certain autotheism, or the worship of oneself, and that's evident among elites such as George Soros, who has candidly confessed that he at times feels himself to be something of a deity. And that you develop that delusion when you inhabit the higher socioeconomic and sociopolitical tiers of society, you can develop the delusion of being in possession of certain deific powers, because when you sign it into law, you know, and suddenly, you know, something that was a specific mandate that proves to be socially and politically expedient to you and serves your needs suddenly is now an existential reality by virtue of the fact that you just had a few pinstrokes and you made a few proclamations. Well, you can see where this Olympian delirium, this autotheism, is easily engendered. It's easy to develop the sense that one is in possession of deific powers, that one is, in fact, their own god.
I think that Henry Kissinger put it best when he said that power is the ultimate opiate, I believe.
Aphrodisiac.
Yeah, the ultimate aphrodisiac. He said that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. So, I mean, he was only speaking partially in jest, I think. I think that there could be something that it could probably be argued that by affecting change, you know, changing the contours of civilization generally through your manipulations at the margin, at the margins, which is what the semi-submerged oligarchy is doing. They're manipulating things from the margins. It actually is probably releasing some kind of endorphins or opiates in these people's minds.
It's actually quite intoxicating. And it actually, you know, if you become something of an autotheist, you engender this sense of one being, you know, inherently divine, then it only helps to affirm that belief and reinforce the sickness. And so, yeah, I mean,
it also gives you a sense of it gives these people a sense of invincibility. For instance, Hillary Clinton, I mean, she's pretty far up the global food chain now via her husband. I mean, there's talk in the news now that her private email server that has possibly violated the Espionage Act, or that her emails, but that the emails that she had, you know, was somehow a violation of the Espionage Act. But what has been her response? Her response has been during the debates to laugh at it. She laughs, you know, so she has a sense that she's untouchable.
Yeah. Whereas if you're just the average Joe, if he refuses to sign a speeding ticket, we'll get tasered by the cop and dragged off the jail.
Yeah, pretty much.
So. But yeah, that's a whole nother. I think you could write an entire book on that.
Oh, absolutely, I mean, absolutely.
But yeah, it's this whole notion they're above the normal rule. They're above the rules. They're above the fray, and they decide. You know, they're the one moving the chess pieces. But in this article, I think you touch on this in your articles, particularly with George Soros. You did various case studies of these destabilization efforts that are spearheaded by the United States, or at least the Western intelligence agencies. Do you want to get into that? You know, Egypt and these NGOs and their function and what's going on there? What's the mechanics behind this? How do you overthrow a government in the 21st century?
Right. NGOs are actually the embodiment of soft power, and soft power is it's this idea of a more subtle destabilization. It was basically put forward by an individual by the name of Joseph Nye. Joseph Nye is a neoliberal. He's a member of the elitist Trilateral Commission, and he describes soft power as the quote ability to get what you want through attraction rather than coercion or payments, and what he suggests is look, avoid, you know, bribery, avoid military campaigns. Instead, bend the will of these countries through the use of soft power, through a subtle seduction. And at one point in the book, he says, at one point in his book, Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics, he says, look, you know, if you can get another person to admire the ideals that you have, if you can get them to have an admiration for the ideals that you are trying to impose on them, you don't have to, you don't have to have sticks and carrots that move them along in the direction that you want them to go. And he says, quote unquote, seduction is always more effective than coercion. Well, for Nye, the non-governmental organization is the embodiment of the practice of soft powers. And if you look at what these non-governmental organizations do, they go into a country under the auspices of humanitarianism, under the auspices they're carried on the wings of some very lofty platitudes. You know, we're just trying to uplift the masses in your country. We're trying to improve the quality of life, you know, the standard of living in your country. But in reality, when NGOs like Freedom House, like the Open Society, show up in these countries, what they really do is they begin to pump funds and training into radicals, into revolutionaries, into individuals in those respective nations, individuals and disparate group and different disenfranchised groups that look to tear down to rip the societal fabric of their countries, tear down society as it is, and rebuild it up in some kind of according to some kind of revolutionary model that they have in their heads. And so the NGOs are used to basically direct these destructive forces to carry out a kind of creative destruction, if you will. And there's been an alliance between government, or at least the criminalized portions of the government, and the NGOs, that has led to this kind of unhealthy influence on foreign policy and national politics. And we saw this, Tim, in Egypt. We saw this in Egypt, where we saw figures connected with the International Crisis Group, like Al-Baridi, who I believe had presidential aspirations over there, and groups like Freedom House, and individuals like John Podesta, who is connected to Soros, who in turn has a number of NGOs such as the Open Society. We saw them working away at the fabric, not just of Hosni Mubarak's regime, but the very fabric of Egyptian society over there, and basically tearing down that country's current the model that existed under Hosni Mubarak, and setting up something that was more amiable to it, that basically was easier to control by Western elites, something else that availed itself more to the control agenda of Western factions of the global oligarchical establishment.
Now, this was Egypt in 2011, but we've had a more recent example of this in the Ukraine with Victoria Nuland boasting about spending $4 billion in the past decade or something to change the political environment in the Ukraine. But there was a coup pulled off that was sponsored by the U.S., openly sponsored by the U.S., just, was it 2 years ago now?
I believe it was 2 years ago, right. And that's pretty much beyond question now. It's not the realm of conspiracy theory. As a matter of fact, Strat for Intelligence, which I believe it was started by George Friedman. It's a very influential influential paper journal with intelligence connections, came right out and said, yeah, you know, the U.S. State Department was behind this attempted coup. But now the thing is that when after that happened, after these U.S. sponsored neo Nazis went to work trying and Nuland went to work trying to take Ukraine, the Russians stepped in, and you know, so it didn't go absolutely to plan. But yeah, that's an example. That's a more recent example of the use, the practice of soft power, because what it does is it's actually a foreign invasion. What we saw in Ukraine, what we saw with Milosevic, what we saw with Hosni Mubarak's Egypt, it's so brilliant. It was actually a foreign invasion, but it appears to be a grassroots uprising. And you know that what the one difference that I can think of with what you're saying, you know, when you cite the Ukraine, is that Russia actually got the smell of this, mm-hmm. and they moved. They moved, especially when it started to head into Crimea, where I believe that they have a military installation there, and it's getting dangerously close. You know, all of a sudden we're getting a NATO foothold dangerously close to Russian territory. You know, Putin said, "Oh no, you don't." You know, so, but yeah, it, like you said, Tim, it is all the same thing. It's that concept of soft power in play. You know, that was basically presented by the neoliberal wing of the establishment. It seems to be the weapon of choice right now, as opposed to what the neoconservatives were proposing, because the neoconservatives just say, hey, let's outright, you know, have a military campaign. Let's put American boots on the ground. The problem with that is it's too crass. And George Soros, this was where George Soros disagreed with George W. Bush. It's too crass. It's too blatant. And what it leads to is the emergence of counter alliances. It leads to something like the BRICS. It leads to Russia and Brazil and China taking issue with your moves and everything, and forming a bulwark.
Yeah. The exercise of soft power has more of the veneer of democracy to it, because ostensibly it's grassroots, and that is very seductive, especially here in the West, where egalitarianism seems to be the order of the day. We look across the sea, we see an uprising such as the uprising against Mubarak, which is, you know, in large measure a Muslim Brotherhood enterprise, which is hardly democratic, hardly egalitarian, but nevertheless it has this egalitarian veneer to it. And so, being that we're enlightened progressive egalitarians here in the West, it's more palpable. But the fact is that all that soft power is really just a camouflaged exercise of imperial power. It's imperial mobilization through proxies abroad.
What's an interesting observation I think you made was about soft power was it's one element of it is to make the target internalize your values.
Absolutely.
That's very similar to reminds me of the project of the Rhodes Trust.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where make the world internalize the idea of British dominance.
Right, right. Yeah. You have that idea that notion was first presented by Cecil Rhodes' mentor in a sense, John Ruskin, when he presented the mandate for a new imperialism, because he saw the British ruling class and that tradition suddenly being immersed within the culture of the vulgar masses, the savages. The only way to reverse that undesirable trend, in his view, was to extend the British tradition, this supposed tradition of aesthetic and cultural superiority, this supposedly beautiful and inherently good tradition, to extend it to the lower tiers of the socio-political and socio-economic food chain, and thereby inculcate the masses into it.
But how are you going to do this? I mean, if you put lobster backs on the ground in the quote unquote colonies, because they still saw them as colonies, you're not going to reclaim the Americas and everything. So what do? Well, you create these round table groups. You place them in British dependencies. And then eventually you meet with like-minded people in America, and you work to set up a stateside sister organization, the Council on Foreign Relations, and it looks like a uniquely American organization, and you don't even see it as a branch of this British parent group.
Right.
That was the, of course, the Council for Relations was created 1921, 22, I guess, about. So that was
I think it was about 1919. It started off as just a regular private kind of discussion group. But then around 21, at the Versailles Treaty and all, they Edward Mandel House, and the Inquiry, which was a group of intelligence figures and social engineers that were starting to get snubbed by Wilson. Wilson was very much a vehicle, a puppet of the elites. That Edward Mandel House was acting as a retainer for, but. But he started to catch on to this. His friendship with House disintegrated, and he started to snub House and, by extension, the Inquiry. House and members of the Inquiry met with British counterparts, and they revamped the group and formed the Council on Foreign Relations.
And of course, this is after the better part of 25 years of attempt by, I guess, the British to reincorporate at least the United States back into the British fold.
Yeah.
The Union Now movement. And this involved the Anglophile elite, the Eastern Seaboard elite, who were always kind of Anglophile.
Right. It involved those Americans who still identified in some sense with the mother country and everything. They still identified in some sense with the British, and so naturally they would find I want to say the Ruskin, but it's
Rhodes.
Yeah, the Rhodes model of world order very appealing, and would be game to whatever. To whatever those disciples of Ruskin had in mind,
and of course this explains the 30-year war against Germany, 19 talking about World War I and World War II, where Germany, for all her faults, if you look at the broader picture, because I look at both conflicts as kind of the same conflict, you really can't separate the two. I think it was Keynes who said it was it was the same war that was divided by, by a 20-year peace, or a 20-year ceasefire.
That was Lord Curzon.
This
peace is no peace. This has only delayed the conflict for, and he hit it right on the head.
He hit the exact number of years between the Great War and World War II, right on the head. You know, and we've only delayed it for this span of years, and it landed right, you know, at the time that he had predicted.
And in both cases, British influence was so strong that it was enabled to drag the United States into both conflicts.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You also had certain British enclaves, such as the Coefficients Club, that laid claim to members such as Bertrand Russell and an individual by the name of Leo Maxey. Mm-hmm. And Leo Maxey had been suggesting war with Germany many, many years in advance of actual conflicts with Germany.
And this was because Germany's ascendancy at the time. Germany was coming on like gangbusters.
They were becoming something of an economic power. And, you know, that's what the British wanted. They wanted dominance over the continent.
Same with Russia, too, right? Russia was a target. Russia, although was an ally, Halford Mackinder, the Earth Island. Russia was considered a threat to British interests, but Russia is too big to attack. So how do you get at Russia? Well, you destabilize Russia. How do you destabilize Russia? You get into war with Germany.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they did that, right? And there's also there's people who look at British Freemasonry involved in the Balkans and that intrigues there with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a difference. There was kind of a schism in Freemasonry, and British Freemasonry was a little bit different than what was existing there on the continent, and the political manifestations that continental Freemasonry that was sprouting from continental Freemasonry did not necessarily lend itself to the geopolitical aims of the British Empire and everything. So you kind of had a sub rosa level to the two conflicts that we had going on there.
But the Rhodes thing, the Rhodes Trust, how the idea of rings within rings, all that's very Freemasonic.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Cecil Rhodes himself was a Freemason. I forget which chapter of Freemasonry he had joined. But actually, he held the irony is he became a Freemason, but he held the order of Freemasonry in derision. He considered it somewhat juvenile, but the structure of Freemasonry, the organizational structure, actually was a chief influence on him, and as was much of the Enlightenment logic that you found in Freemasonry, the Protean thinking of Freemasonry, that found its way into his Confession of Faith and the British Roundtable groups, which of course would give rise to the Royal Institute for International Affairs or the RIIA. All that was patterned after Freemasonry's organizational structure. Mm-hmm. So there are some Masonic elements to the British Rhodes Roundtable organizations and the RIIA. Even though Rhodes himself was somewhat contemptuous of Freemasonry.
Now, have you done a look into, say, subversion of the United States in the 19th century regarding the American Civil War? Or the British? Rothschild involvement?
I know that Rothschild had agents, August Belmont, for instance, on both sides of that fight. Our interpretation of that time was that the Confederacy was mainly, I mean, like there were a lot of well-meaning people within the Confederacy and all, but the Confederacy was mainly an attempt to splinter the nation and create a new kind of a nation of Gulf states that was based on tobacco and slave labor, and that Gulf state would basically be nothing more than a proxy of foreign powers. That was our basic interpretation.
But the interpretation is that Lincoln didn't play ball, and Lincoln didn't. I mean, there's an interpretation that Lincoln, idea of Lincoln going to the European banks to borrow money for the war, but instead printed the greenback.
He printed the greenback, and he did. It was an interest-free money. So, yeah. I mean, and, he incurred the wrath of the banking interest.
Well, it's because his assassin had connections, right? I mean,
The Knights of the Golden Circle, which itself played into Freemasonry and also into the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And into the Confederate Secret Service.
But this goes to your thesis regarding Egypt and other countries is that these elites can exploit fissures and legitimate grievances. And parties that are involved in these conflicts, although they may have legitimate grievances, you know, like the idea of state sovereignty or succession or whether you can use these people's legitimate grievances to achieve another end. For ulterior motives.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So, yeah,
because the one thing that I don't want people to think is that that we're acting as Mubarak apologists.
Yeah, that's our article.
Yeah, Egyptian activists in Egypt prior to the revolution, they weren't tolerated. Mm-hmm. If you said something negative about Mubarak or about his regime, you really ran the risk of being imprisoned, tortured, executed, arrested. And we make sure to point that out in the article. I know that that Transparency International, which is a non-governmental organization, so you can't trust everything it said. I know that in their 2010 Corruption Perceptions Report, they gave Egypt like a score of 3.1, I think it was. 10 is very clean. 0 is highly corrupt. So, you know, you're 3, you're only 2 away from 0. You're pretty corrupt.
We're 3 away from 0.
Yeah, you're 3 away from 0. You're
right.
You're 3 away from 0. You're pretty corrupt and everything.
But nobody is contesting... Nobody's contesting the autocratic pedigree of Mubarak. The fact is that this is where this kind of Manichaean epistemology that has, well, I mean, I don't think it took hold of the American public consciousness as early as the Cold War, but that's when it became most pronounced. It's been with us for many, many centuries.
Yeah, white hat, bad, black hat.
Yeah, yeah. Right. This is where it's very difficult. People can't move past that very flawed moral epistemology. We're not dealing with a dialectic of good versus evil. That's not the dialectic that's at play here. We're dealing with varying degrees of evil. It's not a question of, you know, whether or not, for instance, Saddam Hussein was an SOB. The question is, whose SOB is he? You know, same with Mubarak, same with many of these autocrats, these totalitarians. They are SOBs. Nobody is contesting that fact. But they, if they are our SOB, you know, then suddenly they are inducted into that very exclusive self-righteous exceptionalist category of the white knight. And if they happen to no longer serve American prerogatives,
then you flip the script at that point.
Right.
And the white hat comes off and the black hat comes on.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, that's what the problem with Mubarak was that he had ceased to be a regional proxy of Western elites. He just wasn't playing ball, especially with his refusal of a nuclear umbrella in the region, which is what a lot of elites here wanted. And a nuclear umbrella, by the way, would have allowed for the kind of nuclear blackmail that would get that region to go along with a comprehensive Middle Eastern plan, Middle Eastern peace plan, which could be the stepping stone for integrating that region into a kind of global system, what's been euphemistically referred to as a New World Order.
Mm-hmm. Same thing's going on with Syria now with the Assad regime.
It just seems to be endemic over there. That what's happening is that the autocrats, which used to be very useful to the United States, are just not as. When I say the United States, I actually mean the shadow government and the semi-submerged oligarchy here, Western factions of the elite, not America proper, but. Those autocrats just aren't playing ball the way that they used to, and so the criminalized intelligence circles here, the elite deviants, they fall back on things like their long running symbiotic relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood and with other proxies in that region. For instance, in Iran, there's the Jundallah, there's the Mujahideen al-Khalq. They turn to these radical groups that they've had on and off relationships with, a kind of give and take with, and they're trying to basically pull down the autocrats, and it seems to me set up a kind of Islamic republic, that would be more open to working with interest here in the West, and it's also about keeping those financial markets open and making sure that Western interests don't lose those financial markets.
What you're finding amongst many of these Russian autocrats that now have fallen into disfavor with the Western elite. And what you're finding, you know, also with Vladimir Putin, is this renewed sense of, I guess you could call it, national pride. They have developed more of a deeply held, impassioned clinging to a sense of national sovereignty. You know, we could sit here and argue all day long as to whether or not Putin has converted to Orthodox Christianity and whether or not that's been some sort of factor in his decisions. But one thing we do see with Putin is this emphasis, a renewed emphasis upon national sovereignty. And they're essentially telling Western interests, these dubious Western interests, look, we don't want you here, or what you're doing in this region, that's violating our national interests. And the globalist and the globalist architects of this emergent world government, that renewed emphasis upon national sovereignty is something of an impediment. And so, you know, now I think it's coming back into vogue to renew and revitalize that sense of Russophobia that gripped the United States during the Cold War. I don't know if they can make a very good go of it with calling Putin a commie, because he's not doing a very good job as a communist, if you wanted to make that sort of accusation of him. But they'll no doubt that you'll start seeing renewed citations to previous, you know, historical atrocities by Russia, and the mantra will be, well, Russia's always been a monstrous, tyrannical, you know, power.
But over in the Middle East, we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing that you have autocrats that at one time were willing to act as extensions, merely extensions of Western elites' power over there, and exercised power on their behalf and to their benefit. And they're not playing ball now, and so most of the so we're seeing destabilization, but the destabilization is the result of a third player in the game. I cite an individual that I had some contact with a few years ago in the article, an Israeli investigative journalist by the name of Joel Bainerman. And Joel Bainerman pointed out, there's Jews and there's Arabs involved over in the Middle East in the instability that we see, but the instability is in actuality attributable to a third player, and that third player is what he referred to as the foreign elite, the FE, which he said includes the U.S., Britain, China, France, what have you. So if you look at this as if, say, when you look over in the Middle East and you see some kind of fighting going on between the Palestinians, between Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews, and you see it as just a contest between those two peoples, you're only getting you're really just getting a superficial view of what is going on, of what is happening there.
Well, in terms of seeing Putin or Assad as being some sort, you know, opposing the Atlanticist powers and construing that support as support for the regime itself, I take the view of government is it's the duty of all decent men to be ashamed of the government that they're forced to live under. You know, but that I think H.O. Mencken said that, so it's not my quote. But that's a general view of politics in general. But that said, as you two both mentioned, what these governments represent are national governments that are providing some sort of stumbling block to the New World Order or Anglo-American Empire, however you want to call it. And that's the problem. It's a separate power block, and the people that rule in the West, they're not willing to entertain or be respectful of these nations' legitimate spheres of influence or national security concerns. That right. can be, and of course, that's made self-evident by NATO's expansion since the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is they've incorporated right. the war. Eastern Europe and the entire Warsaw Pact and even parts of former Russia into the alliance.
Right, and that disrespect is endemic to the Enlightenment mentality that was deeply entrenched here in the United States. That Enlightenment universalist belief that this culture somehow is superior, although there's very little in the way of substantial arguments that one could offer for the supposed primacy of our culture. But so superior is this culture that it must be exported abroad, and so you see the importation into countries such as Iraq of pornography, which is really just, pornography's not unique to the West, but it's here in the West that it's proliferated the most. We've had a sexual revolution. It's become...
Well, under the Ministry of Culture, under Saddam Hussein's Ministry of Culture, it was not allowed. I mean, it went on, but it was an underground industry. And after we shown up, there was a very good article... I believe a Newsweek entitled "Iraqi Vice" about this topic.
When it wasn't pervasive.
Yeah, it wasn't pervasive. It was an underground industry, and when we shown up, the military police actually stopped the locals from suppressing it.
Right, and you see a great deal of cognitive dissonance and hypocrisy arising from this cultural imperialism, where we feel that our values are somehow so superior that they must be exported abroad. So we have the importation of pornography abroad, the importation of our own sexual deviant proclivities. And here in the United States, we lock up Jared Fogle,
because of his excesses in terms of pedophilia. But meanwhile, in Afghanistan, pedophiles who are deeply entrenched in the national government are actually receiving protection from our own armed services.
Yeah, well, human trafficking is a huge industry that's aided and abetted by the intelligence agencies for various reasons. That's right. But the Israelis did the same thing with the Palestinians with pornography, by the way. It's a form of psychological warfare.
Yeah, they did that during the Intifada.
Yeah. And if you think – I think E. Michael Jones makes his case is if sexual liberation is freedom and you can – I guess you can say pornography is an expression of sexual freedom – are the Israelis interested in giving the Palestinians freedom?
Well, not in the case of the Intifada.
Exactly. So what's going on there? Obviously, it's being put on the television screen to beguile and corrupt the people to immobilize them politically. So
because you know this was recognized by the revolutionaries that arose from the Enlightenment tradition, such as sexual revolutionaries, such as the Marquis de Sade. They recognized the truth in the statement of Saint Augustine, when Saint Augustine observed that a man has as many masters as he has vices,
mm-hmm.
And if you happen to have just an insatiable sexual appetite. Well, then that is the means by which you can be controlled.
And that's the function there is basically you make someone a slave to their passions, and if you are your job is supplying the satisfaction of those passions, you thereby bring someone under your control.
You're not if you're the slave, you're not going to you're not going to attack the person that peddles to that, that caters to that, because then you're cutting off the line to your drug right there and everything. You know, that's just like that would be like the addict turning on his dealer and everything. And the addict wouldn't imagine doing that as long as he has the addiction and everything. But, you have to laugh when you hear people here in the United States say, whenever they see some kind of pushback against a Western influence over in that part of the world, they say, "Well, they're doing that because they hate our freedoms and all." This is not envy. This pushback is not the embodiment of envy. I mean,
it's more so symptomatic. It's symptomatic of a legitimate sense of revulsion.
I mean, because if you go over there, you know, to the Middle East, you find women in burqas, and that's modesty to them. I mean, it might be a distorted form of modesty. It may, in fact, be a distorted form of modesty, but it's an attempt at modesty at least. It's at least an attempt at modesty. And what do? We want to replace it with tank tops, tramp stamps, tattoos, piercings, you know, and just
which is more offensive? Yeah.
It results in moral anarchy, and they're not ignorant to this fact, and they know that it'll tear at the social fabric over there. So of course they're going to violently regurgitate it and everything, until you know the average rank and file American realizes this, you're never going to get to the solution to this perpetual problem.
Well, it's Aldous Huxley who I think observed that as political and economic freedom diminishes, sexual freedom tends to compensatingly to increase.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
But that explains a lot of the criticism of Putin, where I think last year they passed a law. That restricted, I guess you could say, the proselytizing of youth by homosexuals.
That's right. Which,
by any regular standard, I mean, any normal 30, 40 years ago, this wouldn't shock anybody in the United States, because young people should not be preyed upon by such people. They, you know, they should be left alone, and should be their innocence shouldn't be shocked.
Right.
But they passed this law in Russia, and it's surely it's passed in the West, so it's just sort of fascistic anti-gay law or something.
Right, right. And it also underscores the logically unsustainable premises of the homosexual movement, because on one hand, they want one to accept homosexuality as something that is genetically and biologically predetermined, almost in a very Calvinist sense, that they've no choice in the matter of their sexual orientation. My sexual orientation was already chosen for me, so it was predetermined from the very outset, from my very birth, that I would be homosexual. Some of them even go so far as to make the erroneous claim that they knew they were gay even as children, although children seldom ever think of sex. So why you would be thinking of your sexual orientation at the age of five, you got me. But then on the other hand, while they promote this sexual determinism, they recruit. Well, if you recruit, that presupposes that the recruitee has a choice. So on one hand, we have this sexually deterministic view, and on the other hand, we have this sexual libertarianism.
Yeah, well, that explains the subversive and insidious nature of organized homosexuality.
Yeah.
They have to infiltrate these, you know, whether it's the institutions. It's sort of a kind of a cultural Marxist approach, I guess you could say. But of course, then again, Wilhelm Reich and some of the things he taught, that's how you go about doing it, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, absolutely.
You know, but, you know, again, that's another, it's sort of, there's a, again, these nation states outside the Anglo-American sphere are presenting some sort of stumbling block. This isn't to say that Putin is a saint or a hero by any measure, but again, it's a different power block. And that's something that is worth observing, at least. I had an interesting observation by the girl who goes by the name Syrian Girl. Have you seen her YouTube by any chance?
I've seen her briefly on periodically on Alex Jones's site.
Yeah. She gets a lot of attention, I think largely because she's young and pretty, but that's just the way things are.
Yeah.
But she's also very insightful. I don't want to – got to give her due. She made an observation. She had a recent posting on YouTube, why the New World Order hates Syria. And she went through a litany of things, talking about Assad regime, the pipeline deals that he rejected and he accepted, the government's alliance, you know, with Russia and Iran. But one of the more insightful remarks I think she made was the idea of what's going on, what life was like inside Syria prior to the civil war that was fomented by the West, is that Syria has no central bank. Syria has no Rothschild-controlled central bank, meaning it's outside the Anglo-American banking system. And inside Syria, there are no large Western chains of these corporations. There's no McDonald's. There's no large clothing stores, no Walmarts. And most of the commerce that goes on there is conducted by smaller, mid-sized companies. Even they have their own Coca-Cola or own cola industry, which uses pure sugar cane and not high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
And I thought it interesting she would label this as, or at least identify this as one of the reasons why it's being targeted, because much of what we see in what's going on in the world today is this attempt to sort of homogenize and incorporate the entire world into this one global corp situation, I think.
Yeah. Well, again, that goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that you got to keep that market open to Western interest. And if it's a closed market, you got to open it, and you got to sustain that once you have it open. And I mean, but you don't even have to look at Syria for this. Look at, for instance, Allende's Chile, Salvador Allende. Again, an individual who wasn't a saint by any stretch of the imagination, but still, I mean, he was. He was challenging monopolies by Western interest in Chile, namely Anaconda Copper. He wanted them out. He was going to nationalize industry and get rid of Anaconda Copper and PepsiCo ITT.
Incidentally,
which, by the way, bribed the CIA, gave the CIA a bribe.
Yeah, like wasn't, the CIA. Wasn't Richard Helms also a former lawyer for them or a former board member?
I believe that he was. I believe that he was. There's a whole revolving door between corporate interests and the Central Intelligence Agency that screams conflict of interest.
Well, that was founded on Alan Dulles. Look at United Fruit and
I mean the most powerful law firm in the world. So I mean on Wall Street at least, Sullivan and Cromwell. That's where he and his brother came from. But the minute that Salvador Allende decided to do this, he's going to get rid of ITT. He's going to get rid of Anaconda Copper, PepsiCo. He's kicking them out. He's nationalizing industry. That's when the destabilization efforts begin. That's when Richard Corey, the ambassador over there, amps up the sanctions, and then a second covert track went into play, Augusto Pinochet is encouraged to mutiny with the military, and we all seen what happened. Allende was killed, and Pinochet came in and became basically an extension of American interest over there for many, many, many years until he finally left when he was like in his ninth decade of life. He was finally out of, and given sanctuary by Britain and everything. But for many years he kept it open to those Western interests. Yeah. But if I may add, I'm not calling into question. I'm not trying to cast any aspersions upon what Syria girl was saying there. That's very much true. But there's another dimension to this, why Western elites might have turned against Assad, that I would ask your listening audience to consider. This comes via intelligence sources, among them Robert Baer. Robert Baer has been one of the people that said this. He was former CIA. I believe he was stationed over in Beirut. Really knows a lot about the region. He's cagey in what he says, but he knows a lot about the region, and so it shouldn't be ignored. Back after the 9/11 attacks, Assad came to the United States. It didn't physically come, but he came in the sense that he was speaking with the, opened up channels with the United States, saying, "Look, we can help you with the GWAT, with the global war on terror and all. The trunk of the tree of terrorism is the Muslim Brotherhood." He's like, "We have a list of all their names. We have a list of where they're at." The Assad dynasty has hated the Muslim Brotherhood ever since they shelled Hamas into oblivion. Because the Muslim Brotherhood was deeply entrenched in Hamas. They weren't moving. So the Assad just leveled the place to try to destroy the Muslim Brotherhood. He said, "We'll give you this list. You can hunt them down. You can destroy them." And all. The only thing that we have only one condition in return. One condition: please do not invade Iraq. Well, we see what the Bush administration did with this proposition. And one of the reasons is that they wanted to go into Iraq to have a kind of regional foothold over there. But also, they weren't going to destroy the Muslim Brotherhood because we've had a symbiotic relationship with them since at least 1953. Miles Copeland, who was with the CIA, admitted as much. He pointed out, "Look, we wanted to control the people over there, so we were looking for the Muslim equivalent of Billy Graham. We couldn't find the Muslim equivalent of Billy Graham. We couldn't find a charismatic leader like that. So we turned to the Brotherhood. We opened up channels with the Brotherhood." And prior to the CIA, the British were doing this. British intelligence was in contact as early as the 1920s with the Muslim Brotherhood through the travel agent and British agent Freya Stark, and so So they didn't want the elites here did not want to destroy what they consider to be a very valuable asset in the Muslim Brotherhood. So
this is the mystical imperialism that Gould and Fitzgerald talk about.
Yeah, it's connected to that. It certainly plays into that, and so they see that Assad is an opponent of the Brotherhood. They see that he is a major force to be reckoned with in this fight with the Brotherhood, in his opposition with the Brotherhood, and he's determined to destroy them, and so this might have motivated some of the movement against him, you know, to get his hands away from a group that the West has been in a symbiotic relationship for many years now, and is basically a group with many splinters, many offshoots, all of which have at one time or another acted as proxies for Western interest and have helped the West to reshuffle that Middle Eastern chessboard when it needed to be, whether it be in the case of Hosni Mubarak, because we were supporting the Brotherhood against Mubarak, or against before Mubarak, years before Nasser, when Nasser became a problem and was no longer a proxy that would play ball. He was assassinated by the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood has also been a real asset in other places over there as well for Western elites.
This is an interesting dynamic you bring up, the symbiotic, but I would argue probably also operational link between Western intelligence and Islamic fundamentalism. Why would the West be interested in fomenting and aiding the spread of Islamic fundamentalism? Because we've seen it in Egypt, we've seen it in Iran, we saw it in Afghanistan. I think we've seen it with the Muslims in the Balkans. Are these shock troops, destabilization agents that we use?
Yeah, that's what they basically act as when Western elite deviants turn to them. That's what they're looking for them to act as is shock troops that destabilize a given area. There's also some overlap in thinking there, actually, because the Muslim Brotherhood has its own unique model of free trade that isn't really that all too different from the model of free trade that is promoted by Western elites. But there's also a shared kind of Gnosticism there there's Gnostic thinking among the Western elites, and there's Gnostic thinking among the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, you look at, for instance, Paul mentioned earlier, he mentioned the concept of creative destruction, which is actually a dialectical commonality you see shared among both the neoliberals and the neoconservatives.
Now, creative destruction, that was in economics, it's Joseph Schumpeter, idea of competition and outmoded industries being replaced. So economically, it's kind of benign.
Yeah, it's Schumpeter within the economic realm. But Michael Ledeen,
he applies it geopolitically.
Yeah, right. Michael Ledeen, who was the sponsor of Manuker Gorbanifar, who played a role in Iran-Contra. Michael Ledeen also played a role in Iran-Contra, and also Ledeen also played a role in trying to blame the Bulgarians for the attempt on John Paul II's life. That whole thing didn't work out the way that he planned it, but Ledeen is this kind of neoconservative operative. He's the one that introduced the whole idea of creative destruction to the realm of politics.
Right. And it's with this notion of creative destruction where you have basically the eradication of an entire civilization, supposedly for the purposes of giving rise to a new more, you know, more beautiful, more enlightened form of civilization. You find with that a certain docetistic strain of thought that was endemic to Gnosticism. The chief error of Gnostic theology was its assignment of an ontological status to evil. The Gnostic thought of evil in terms of ontology, not moral orientation. So in other words, the Gnostic concretized corruption, concretized darkness, concretized evil. The Gnostic bestowed upon evil form and substance. It was understood as something with definite, tangible properties. And so as such, it was projected outside of man's intangible will and externalized. And with evil no longer being imputable to the intangible will, the belief in sin was inevitably rejected. Instead, evil was reinterpreted as all that was external to the Gnostics and their supposedly enlightened mind. And, you know, because corruption was allegedly interwoven into the very ontology of the external world, it and all that it contained was regarded as irredeemable. Well, within certain Gnosio-Hermetic texts, you'll find two strains of Gnosticism. You have the overtly docetistic variety of Gnosticism, which makes no secret of its derision for the physical cosmos, for the ontological confines of the material universe. It is viewed as this cosmic cesspool and a horrible mistake, a horrible error. But then there's also this tacitly docetistic form of Gnosticism that you see in these Gnosio-Hermetic texts. It's not overtly docetistic. It's not overtly contemptuous of the material universe. As a matter of fact, it's ostensibly world affirming. It holds the world initially in high regard, but the docetism begins to emerge when you examine that depiction of the physical universe a little bit closer. This depiction of the it depicts the universe as actually being nothing more than a receptacle, a kind of a container for some incorporeal good, and so that incorporeal good, that good that is either masked by or contained within matter, can be accessed. But what happens to a container when its more desirable contents are accessed? Well, you know, anybody who's gone to a birthday party knows that the wrapping paper goes into the trash. Same with this tacitly docetistic form of Gnosticism. And that's the sort of attitude that you see in Michael Ledeen's creative destruction. We have to access the incorporeal good that it lurks just behind the material veneer of a civilization, but that's going to entail its destruction. And you also see elements of Gnosticism in the neoconservative and the neoliberal mind with this Manichaean partitioning off of humanity into these intractable binary oppositions, good against evil, which the problem with that sort of partitioning off of humanity into those very intractable categories is the fact that it overlooks the inherent complexity of human morality. Now, that's not to say that I'm somehow affirming moral relativism. Moral relativism obviously is self-refuting, because if all morality is relative, then so is the statement that all morality is relative. but what I am acknowledging is the fact that human beings are a complex amalgam of both, and that's even attested to by sacred scripture. And sacred scripture it says that man partook of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So he has knowledge of both. And at times he'll follow his better angels. At times he'll follow his lower demons. And the problem is that man's epistemic faculties by which he apprehends the good are fallen, and so occasionally he falls short. This is made evident by a particular piece of scripture that says there is a way that seems right unto them to a man, but the ends thereof are death. What I'm citing is a problem with moral epistemology, but that doesn't hold any sort of ramifications for moral ontology, for the objective properties of moral values. But the long way around the barn, you see this sort of Manichaean epistemology with the neoliberals, with the neoconservatives, with the Enlightenment rationalist of globalism, and you see it very much alive with the Muslim Brotherhood. In addition, you have with the Muslim Brotherhood this drive to basically invoke the parousia, to bring about a second coming, to bring about the judgment day by the efforts of man himself.
Well, you also see it with their understanding of jihad. No longer is it a war against sin, it's actual physical war. You can actually destroy evil by engaging in physical war,
right,
and destroying your enemies in a very real physical sense.
But that's no different from the neoconservative or the neoliberal or the cold warrior here in the United States. For instance, evil was during the Cold War, evil was the Soviet Union. That's, as a matter of fact, Ronald Reagan invoked a very Manichaean epistemology when he called the Soviet Union the evil empire. Forget for the moment that we were doing many of the things that the evil empire were doing,
mm-hmm,
at the same time.
That's,
With
this, when you say concretization of evil, I guess the best example of that would be when the neoconservatives write books like An End to Evil.
Yes, absolutely.
Something you can physically destroy. As opposed to me, by your understanding, is that ending evil would be to end human nature, and that can't be done. Evil is an essential part of the human condition, and you have to contend with that reality. As opposed to, evil is over there. We can bomb them into submission. We can firebomb Dresden,
exactly,
destroy Berlin, or nuke Hiroshima, or invade these countries and drain the swamps, as they say. But that's
exactly.
Yeah.
And an interesting corollary of this concretization of evil is as Saint Basil the Great noted, it invariably results in a rebound of blame to the creator himself. So you invariably arrive at a certain Masothism. Which was the case, for instance, with the ancient Gnostics. The ancient Gnostics considered God the Creator to be evil. Because he created the material universe. The material universe is allegedly intrinsically evil, and so by extension, so is the God who created it. And the only way that they could really redeem God was by bifurcating his divine being into two separate beings. One was God the Creator, who was viewed as intrinsically evil, and the other was God the Heavenly Father, who was absolutely transmundane and created nothing. You see that Masothism very much alive here in the United States with none other than the New Atheist. The New Atheist have this very binary outlook. They represent the purveyors of reason. And everybody else represents the evil forces of superstition, religious institutions, particular religious faiths. Those are intrinsically evil. And by the way, I'm not the only person to have identified these these parallels between the new atheism and Gnosticism. It was none other than Chris Hedges, who is certainly no friend of Christianity, who first identified the fact that the new atheist had these proclivities. He also identifies the new atheist's externalization of evil, their refusal to acknowledge the fact that evil's point of origin is the intangible will of man, especially their own intangible will. They project it onto the other. They project it onto the Ken Hams of the world, the Kirk Camerons. Surely they are the embodiment of evil. We are the embodiment of reason, which for whatever reason we've arrived at the conclusion is somehow intrinsically good. But if you notice with the new atheists, they consistently, on one hand, they claim to reject the very existence of God, but then on the other hand, they bestow upon him particular attributes that you wouldn't bestow upon the tooth fairy, which is a very, you know, one of the very analogs that they use for God. Well, God must be a tooth fairy or a flying spaghetti monster, but you would never call the tooth fairy misogynistic, genocidal, you know, sexist, tyrannical. And yet these are precisely the same adjectives that people such as Richard Dawkins bestow upon God. Well, implicit in that bestowal of all these horrible, terrible attributes is in actuality a tacit misotheism that is not unlike the misotheism of the Gnostics. And so you see here in the West that Gnostic mentality very much alive, and it parallels the Gnostic mentality of the Muslim Brotherhood. As enlightened and as progressive as we'd like to think of ourselves, we're really no different from them in that sense.
Mm-hmm. You made an interesting observation regarding neoconservatives and the Islamic or Muslim Brotherhood, regarding their imminent eschatology.
That's right. That's right.
You see this with the Christian Zionist movement, and where the idea is we must support Israel in the Middle East because we need to bring on the conflict to urge on the second coming.
Right.
Meaning we've got to push God a little bit, I guess you could say.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But that kind of belies the other insanity of the policy, I guess, because obviously they're not interested in stability, peace, or coming to some accord to improve conditions. They want war.
Right. They want war. War is a necessary prerequisite for the parousia, mm-hmm. in according to their own eschatology, especially the post-millennial reconstructionist eschatology, or as it's been called by some sociologists, dominionism. And this actually resulted from a revision to Gnosticism. Of course, Gnosticism initially held the physical world in contempt. The ultimate eschatological hope for the Gnostic was to be reabsorbed into the pleroma, to just enjoy disembodied bliss. But with the introduction of a mystic by the name of Jakob Boehm, that changed. Jakob Boehm revised Gnosticism. He introduced to Gnosticism a previously foreign element. He introduced theodicy, you know, the view that attempts to reconcile the existence of a good God with the existence of evil, with the existence of suffering. And the way that Jakob Boehm, his theodical revision of Gnosticism worked, was he no longer viewed materiality as a horrible mistake, which, according to the traditional Gnostic cosmology, that was precisely what it was. It was a horrible mistake. no longer was materiality, no longer were the ontological confines of the physical universe an error. Instead, they represented a necessary phase in God's own journey towards self-knowledge. And this belief that God was gradually migrating towards self-knowledge through man within the confines of the physical universe, that was transmitted to the Romantic movement, and one of the members of the Romantic movement was none other than George Friedrich Hegel. And George Friedrich Hegel, this is from whence his dialectic of history comes.
Yeah.
And Hegelianism pervades mm-hmm. the thinking of the globalists.
Problem, reaction, solution, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The synthesis arising from the collision of two binary oppositions, the thesis and the antithesis. And so you can see very much in Hegel Gnostic thinking, but with the introduction of the element of theodicy, with the theodical revisions of Jakob Boehm, where materiality is no longer viewed as evil but necessary. It's a necessary phase in God's gradual migration towards self-knowledge. In this case, for the Romanticist, man was God. He simply forgot. He underwent some sort of spiritual amnesia, and now he's gradually migrating back towards his deific consciousness. And that's what the dialectic of history was supposed to facilitate, was his gradual migration back towards this gnosis, this self-knowledge. And that is very much also evident with the Muslim Brotherhood, who views parousia, the end of days, the eschaton, as something that is to be induced by human efforts.
In that regard, I'd like to point out that in our article, we go into the very comfortable relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and the International Crisis Group, which included individuals such as Zbigniew Brzezinski, but also El Baradei, who actually went over there. El Baradei, he ostensibly resigned from the ICG, from the International Crisis Group, to go over and to spearhead the revolution against Hosni Mubarak. And when he received support for a time, at least, from the Muslim Brotherhood in his efforts. When Baradei was over there, he began to basically outline what the objectives of the Egyptian revolution were. And at one point, he stated, quote, "We have to have a government of national salvation," unquote. Well, when Baradei said that, he was basically presenting the state. He was presenting the new government as a vehicle of salvation, as a kind of salvific tool. And now, so he's imbued it with all this soteriological value, and that's no different than the secular Gnostic that we see here in the West. The secular Gnostic here in the West, like the neoconservative, who says, "Oh well, there's going to be an end to history. You know, we're going to enter a utopian permanence, and we're going to move out of flux." It's no different than the whole idea in social democracy that there's going to be an earthly city that's perfect, and it's no different than the end of the dialectical clash as interpreted by Marx. This idea that there's going to be a kind of Hegelian apocalypse leading to a stateless paradise.
Yeah, you hear among sociopolitical utopians
all the time, many of them being vehemently anti-theistic, but nevertheless, in the invocation of very religious, in particular, soteriological terms. With Barack Obama and his campaign, the labels that were attached to the man were distinctly messianic, and that's very much symptomatic of a Gnostic, well, the new Gnostic mentality, where suddenly all these the soteriological value can be found in the state, soteriological value can be found in the paracletic sectarian leader, as Voegelin called it in the New Science of Politics. You see this imbuing of soteriological value, you know, in the state and in the machinations thereof. But Alberide, his government of national salvation, can just be seen as a more recent manifestation of the idea of an earthly paradise that the secular Gnostics wanted to realize. And again, he was part of the International Crisis Group. Another major mover and shaker within the International Crisis Group was Zbigniew Brzezinski. Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote Between Two Ages, where he talked about technotronic era, which was really nothing more than regurgitated technocratic thinking.
Yeah.
So no doubt this new earthly paradise that Alberide was seeking to bring about in Egypt, this government of national salvation, probably, if all things had worked out the way that they wanted, would have had features of Brzezinski's technotronic era in it, a more managed society with experts supplanting traditional political leaders.
With Brzezinski, of course, he was handpicked by David Rockefeller in the early 70s.
That's correct.
Spearhead the Trilateral Commission. Of course, then Trilateral Commission is where Carter was pulled from, President Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. What had happened is at the time, the Western elites were losing their clout in the United Nations, which was supposed to was another one of these vehicles that was supposed to impose upon the world the Western elites' model of world order. But what was happening was that the General Assembly was becoming plagued with socialist and communist bloc nations that didn't always act in symbiosis with the West. Mm-hmm. They would compete and everything. There was also a considerable loss of power within the traditional repository of Atlanticist power, which would be the Council on Foreign Relations, because people had kind of gotten a sense that the foreign policy architects that had come from the CFR. Had been behind the Vietnam War debacle. They had jettisoned Lyndon Johnson and tried to place the blame solely on him, and by extension, the Southern Rim elite. And the Southern Rim elite were very much responsible for a lot of that debacle.
That was the function of the Pentagon Papers, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, the Pentagon Papers served many different covert agendas. But the main thing that was trying to do was shift the blame from the intelligence community, from the CIA in particular, which was more of a Atlanticist enclave,
yeah,
and place the onerous for the war on the military, which was more of a Southern Rim enclave.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the Yankee cowboy thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. The Yankee cowboy competition that we see going on there. Oh. Well, that move, you know, Johnson didn't seek re-election, so it did in some sense work, but it didn't work entirely because people got the smell, and they knew that the foreign policy architects, the wise men, if you will, that were behind the Vietnam War were all leftovers from Kennedy, from the Kennedy administration, and were all Atlanticists that had pushed Lyndon Johnson in that direction. And Lyndon Johnson, this Southwestern good old boy cowboy, you know, he didn't like them. He didn't particularly like any of those individuals, but he respected their experience. And so he reposed his trust in them, which ended up being an ill-conceived move on his part. And all. And people saw this Atlanticist influence in the Vietnam debacle. And so the Council on Foreign Relations had lost some of its clout. So at the time had emerged for a new organization. So in 1972, David Rockefeller commissioned Zbigniew Brzezinski to start seeking personnel and drafting plans for a new group that would basically follow kind of the same agenda as the Council on Foreign Relations, but would not be readily recognizable as an establishment imagination as the Council on Foreign Relations had. The people had come to recognize it as just mainly a imagination of the establishment. And so that's where the Trilateral Commission came from. And like you said, Jimmy Carter could be considered the first trilateral president. He wanted to be an outsider desperately, but all for naught. You know, the only real way that Jimmy Carter only acted as an outsider in one real sense, in his attempted reforms of the intelligence community, and that was it.
And that arguably cost him his reelection.
yeah.
Because the Halloween massacre, and I think you have all types of intrigues.
Well, they hated him. They hated him, and they hated Stansfield Turner for what he did there.
Yeah,
and because it had displaced people like Theodore Shackley and his deputy Tom Clines, and so they ended up finding refuge with in different machinations, private intelligence groups, such as the Safari Club, which was spearheaded by the Saudis.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But it's also important to point out that Carter also refused to reappoint George H.W. Bush.
That's right.
So
that's right. And all.
So go ahead. Continue. I'm sorry. Go.
No. You're absolutely correct. Correct in that call. But like I said, that was probably the only real move that Carter did. Where he, in his writings prior to reaching the presidency, he acknowledged that there was an establishment. And he acknowledged that he wanted to break ranks with the establishment and bring, you know, a fresh perspective to Washington and all. But that was the only way in which he demonstrated any kind of divergence. I mean, if you look at, for instance, Iran, and we look at Iran in our article over the Egyptian
Revolution. Yeah, why don't you mention that? Because you mentioned some intrigues there that most people aren't aware of, meaning the U.S. backing of Khomeini and the undermining of the Shah. What exactly was going on there? Can you go into that?
Yeah. I'll go into a little bit of that. There was a lot of intrigue going on there. Carter, the Savak secret police over there was not in the control of the Shah. Was not under Shah Reza Pahlavi's control. It was under the control of Western intelligence people that were acting as quote unquote consultants. Well, what they did is they ended up having a crackdown on people, a domestic crackdown over in Iran, and then what the Carter administration would do was cynically blame that crackdown on the Shah. Well, because Shah did not control the secret police; it was Western interest coming, from America that were controlling those interests. So the administration was working to create portrait of an oppressive regime over there. And granted, he was oppressive, and for many years he was. May there be no doubt that the Shah was not a good man and was initially very much a puppet of Western interest. He was brought in to displace Mossadegh. Mossadegh, again, trying to nationalize the oil fields. Bad idea.
He'd run afoul of Crumlin and Sovwell. Sullivan and Crumlin and their clients.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And but what also took place is that the Ayatollah was staffed with people that were on the CIA payroll, and the West moved him when the Shah moved against the Ayatollah. They didn't allow the Shah to execute him or kill him or something. They allowed him to go to Iraq, where Saddam Hussein was still very much a Western asset, and the Saddam allowed him in on behalf of the West, and then from there to France, where he was set up by the CIA. His whole operation continued over there with CIA patronage and everything, and then the CIA brought him back into the country, and the West also, the British also played a role in the destabilization of the Shah, because they were buying large amounts of oil from Iran. They decided that they wanted to cause economic stressors that could then be blamed on the Shah there in the country. So they cut back on the amount of oil that they were buying, and then Khomeini came in. Again, we have a Muslim Brotherhood connection there, because Ayatollah Kashani, who was the mentor of Khomeini, was a part of a Muslim Brotherhood subsidiary in Iran, an Iranian Muslim Brotherhood. And Muslim Brotherhood backed clerics were fighting for the deposing of the Shah too, and they were backed by the CIA. And so the whole regime of the Shah's regime was brought down, with the support of the Carter administration, and the Ayatollah came in, and the country became something of an Islamic Republic, a bastion of fanaticism. Later on, the revolution took on a more, it ceased to be, in its beginnings, it was most definitely synthetic, but it took on a more organic character later on, and more moderate forces found their way into the government. for instance, I know people made a lot to do over Ahmadinejad. And Ahmadinejad was a bad person. He was bipolar. He was not stable.
He also had no power, though.
but he didn't have the power to. Yeah. If he wanted to do something, he had to go to the new Ayatollah. He had to go to the religious authority, and he had to go to the military. And if the military wasn't going to dance, and if the religious clerics weren't going to dance, he couldn't just unilaterally do anything. So there have been moderate forces that have become that have mangled themselves in the government over there.
He serves sort of as a pressure valve. Over there, or you know, he'd say that say things, and
I think that's a really unique way of seeing him. he was mentally. I personally see him as mentally not stable, and all. But he served the purpose in the respect that he cathartically dispelled.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of resentment, some of which was well founded towards the West.
Oh, there is a basis for resentment and fear in Iranian history.
well, again, people here in the United States seem to think they've been told that they hate us for our freedoms, mm-hmm. because of our freedoms. There wasn't envy that was driving this. Okay, there wasn't envy. You're not envious. When British Petroleum and Schwarzkopf's father and the Dulleses move against your country because Mossadegh is going to nationalize the oil fields and all, you know, what you're mad about there is you're mad about foreign intrusion into domestic affairs and all. So the resentment went all the way back. The resentment towards the West went back all the way to the days of Mossadegh.
And the seizure of the embassy is interesting because it was the embassy from which that coup plot emanated from. The CIA used the embassy to stir up the crowds, create the synthetic crowds and the violence that led to the fall of Mossadegh and the installation of the Shah, the reinstallation of the Shah.
Right. So absolutely.
There is a reason to suspect, and of course. What they found when the embassy was seized, there was all types of skullduggery that was revealed.
are you talking about the when the embassy was seized after the Ayatollah Khomeini's return to
in November 79?
Mossadegh had been long out of the way by then.
I'm saying the reaction is in 1954, 53.
Oh.
Before the embassy was the focal point for that operation.
Exactly. That's true.
And they knew that. So this is why they surrounded the embassy again. This creates another element of intrigue to this because, of course, the seizure of the embassy occurred after Carter had allowed the Shah into the country for medical treatment, ostensibly.
Yeah. The Shah was dying, I believe, of prostate cancer at the time.
And of course.
maybe that might have been one of the reasons to depose him because if he's dying – then you need to replace him quickly. You can't let him just die in office because then you might have elections and a degree of self-determination might actually find its way into the internal politics of Iran but I don't necessarily believe that Rockefeller and Kissinger meant specifically for the embassy, because they're the ones that influenced Carter's decision to bring the Shah here.
But they didn't
specifically have in mind necessarily students storming the embassy. Mm-hmm. They did have in mind some kind of general radical response to that they could then exploit.
Yeah, kind of like they didn't care. They just want something to happen. And of course, the hostages ended up being pawns in many political games in the ensuing years. As Barbara,
the Ayatollah kindly took them off of the students' hands and took control of it. The students never meant for it to last as long as it did.
But it did help. It did put Chase Manhattan back in the black again.
Yeah, absolutely.
They had a problem with the Shah's Iran's assets. Iran was going to take him out of the bank. And the ensuing crisis solved that problem for Chase Manhattan, which is kind of like how the ruling elite operate.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I don't think it's beyond the realm of reasonable suspicion to think that there is some stirring the pot in Iran in order to precipitate a crisis that would justify the seizing of the assets.
Well, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
If you don't think they think that far ahead, they play three-dimensional chess all the time, so
Absolutely. Well, before the interview, what did I mean, I was telling you about a CIA memorandum that mentions Margaret Thatcher, George H.W. Bush, and Ronald Reagan before any of them had become major players on the political scene.
That's not too – I mean, there's a book by Craig. I think it's spelled Krieg, but he pronounces it Craig, called Presidential Puppetry.
Oh, I've heard of that one. I have not had an opportunity to read that just
and
yet.
And if you're just – I mean, our current president. he appears to be a complete creation of the intelligence community, if you ask me. So,
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're currently putting together a new book, and we go into some of his intelligence connections.
Yeah,
back when he worked as a journalist,
mm-hmm.
and if you look at his father and his stepfather's background, his mother's background at the college there in Hawaii. And everything. It really start to get the traces of an intelligence portfolio there.
Now, the article we're talking about, again, it's an I counted 80 pages, 70 pages maybe of text.
It's pretty long.
Yeah.
It is pretty long.
you get into this whole ideological sort of revolutionary fervor, fire in the minds of men, and you close it referring to Dostoevsky's The Possessed. And that brings to mind Jane Billington's Fire in the Minds of Men, this idea of revolution, fire going out of control. To what extent is it a fire out of control? To what extent are these fires being created and stoked by the elites, and they're actually managing the whole thing? What do you think is going on there? I'm only bringing this up because we're coming into closing minutes of the interview. I don't want to kind of close it out that way. How do you look at these events? Are they completely managed, or are they just manipulated from time to time? What's going on here?
Well, I just think that they periodically manage things from the margins,
mm-hmm.
and it's a in the movie The International, which is basically a fiction that's based on the story of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International.
Yeah, yeah.
The bank's head, Skarsen, at one point, you know, like they're talking about one of their competitors, and the other members of the cabal within the bank, and they're like, would so and so take this risk? And he's like, we do all the time, you know. So that the same principle applies in the real world. What they do is they manipulate things from the margins. They get the ball rolling in a certain direction, and the outcome may not resemble their desired outcome in every single aspect, but it approximates it really, really well. And there's risk taking there too. There's the risk that it might not go necessarily to plan, because what they're doing is they're not so much making a certain outcome an inevitability. What they're doing is they're increasing the likelihood. They're increasing the likelihood of a certain outcome that they have in mind. So there's always that possibility that things might go off the rails. A case in point would be, like we were speaking about before the show, would be the depopulation agenda of the elite. That was meant to bring about a human thoroughbred, and it was also meant to diminish the collective carbon footprint of the human race, and thus bring about a ecological balance. Neither one of those goals were met. There is no human thoroughbred. There is no Soviet man. There is no Aryan. There is no perfect man, and all. And ecology is still out of whack in some ways, and everything. What it has resulted in is a demographic winter, which is destroying the social, political, and economic stability that they require to to see their model of world order fully instantiated. And you know, the replacement births just aren't there to sustain the infrastructure that they have in mind, because I mean they what they have in mind is global in its global infrastructure. That's going to take a lot of people. That's going to take a lot of miners. That's going to take a lot of laborers. That's going to take a lot of people on all different levels to keep it going. And the numbers just aren't there. And the numbers don't play to their favor and everything. So so to answer your question, you know, they merely increase the likelihood of something happening, but they do not ensure the inevitability of something happening. And the way that relates to these revolutions, these colored revolutions that they've fomented, you know, they can direct that rage, they can direct those disenfranchised peoples that they've radicalized to an extent, but they can't guarantee the success of those people entirely, and they can't guarantee that those people will always do what they what they had in mind. I mean, there is some very good research out there contended that Hitler was mainly meant to be a bulwark against communism, but he in some sense got off the rails, and you know, because he actually moved against the capitalist as well. So it doesn't always go to plan.
That was the Hitler project, the theory.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think that there's some legitimacy in that view.
Well, I can see how the British would say, hey, let's destabilize Germany. And you do see those policy decisions being taken in the 20s and 30s. Well, you see even the war itself, but you really see it happening in the late 20s and 30s with the failing of the credit on stock bank and all that stuff, the financial crisis. But then you have the people like the Western New York and Wall Street moving in and kind of cannibalizing or taking advantage of Germany in the 20s and 30s.
Right. You know, I think that you – with the Dulles brothers made sure that the Germans had to pay the majority of reparations for the war.
And that's the Bank of International Settlements, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tied in. I mean, they made sure that the great bulk of war reparations would have to be paid by the Germans. They knew that would bankrupt the Republic. It would destroy the Republic over there. And that it would radicalize the people. I think that they were trying to push them into a socialist trajectory by doing that. Whether it was the National Socialism as envisioned by Adolf Hitler, that's something that could be debated.
But that does go towards the roughly speaking, you do have the objectives of the Mackinder Doctrine being satisfied there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, I mean, you do see in Nazi imperialism the ideas of Haushofer, who was another one of those thinkers along the lines of Mackinder in terms of geopolitics.
But even Nazi geopolitical visions were informed, at least influenced, heavily influenced by the blockade, the British blockade.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea of Lebensraum and securing the Ukraine and these things, and of course Bolshevism, and of course Anthony Sutton had a thing or two to say about Bolshevism and Wall Street and the idea of captured markets and destabilizing.
Oh yeah, captured markets, which is what it became in Russia when the Bolsheviks came to power. A lot of oil wells got shut down, and the Rockefellers lost a lot of competition there.
And that's what it is. When you own these assets and you can knock them out of the market for a while, the assets you own are that much wealthier.
And absolutely.
I think a lot of the conservation efforts in the 20th century were influenced by those interests, like Pinchot Gifford and they're all, you know, working for these interests. You know, the idea of carving out huge swaths of land and declaring it conserved.
Right. Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And so that's also with the World Wildlife Federation in Africa and things like that. You know, that's,
well, there was actually terrorist organizations that were training on World Wildlife Protected Land. Food for thought and further research.
Exactly. And of course, Stalin himself might have represented a person or a figure who got too big for his britches. You know.
Yeah, we talk about that in the in our article over the what has been called the cult of the superweapon. Mm-hmm. When Oppenheimer, it appears to us that Oppenheimer and some of those scientists in the Manhattan Project were passing secrets to Stalin because they were hoping to internationalize the bomb. Mm-hmm. And the goal that they hoped would be achieved by doing that, by internationalizing it, was that both East and West would accept some kind of world government that would prevent an arms race. Well, that's not the way it worked out.
No, it's not the way it worked out at all. But then again, you could say that maybe the entire arms race itself was sort of a construct, because all that weaponry someone got rich off of.
Yeah, it certainly came to be manipulated by forces like Team B, which was basically the privatization of intelligence, where the CIA isn't making things scary enough for the public consumption. It handed over to William Pipes and his boys, and they'll make it look a lot more scary. They'll get the nuclear anxiety going.
And that gets into what you call, you when you wrote about the CFR in the article, Council of Foreign Relations, how in the early days of the Cold War, it was a sort of a government within a government, because all their research, all that money, all the foundation money that had gone to influencing the press coverage, creating the perception of a threat, overwhelmed the State Department.
Yeah.
Created the contours of the Cold War.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And something to think about today, about who's influencing our perception of what's going on in the world and creating fear, right? And of course, creating fear is what, you know, the ruling elite rely on, because through fear, problem, reaction, solution. And
yeah.
Well, so, but that's,
our new book is going to be called Invoking the Beyond, and we go into the concept of a beyond, which is basically it's a
set of circumstances or a particular narrative construct, mm-hmm. that is introduced into the overall narrative of geopolitics, that where nation states are dwarfed ontologically and epistemologically, and because they are just ill-suited to deal with this beyond, whatever it may happen to be, if it happens to be environmental degradation, an atomic bomb, or even something as fantastical as alien visitation, alien invasion, or alien visitation. You know, this belief that man is going to be introduced into the cosmic brotherhood of other planets. Whatever the beyond happens to be, whatever shape it takes, it invariably results in the ontological and epistemological dwarfing of legitimate national governments, and these national governments in turn have to turn to more of a transnational managerial model that is presented as the veritable deus ex machina, the God from the machine, the savior, in order to solve the political and social conundrums that invariably arise.
And whenever people come across something that totally transcends their epistemological, their own private personal epistemological spectrums, they are then convinced that the current model of world order is ill-equipped to deal with the situation.
And it collapses.
Yep.
Yeah, that's kind of like Arthur C. Clarke, who said that all advanced technology first appears as magic.
You know? Yep.
And so, yeah, it's kind of like probably something that the Aztecs faced when the conquistadors showed up, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, listen, gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. You really pushed the limit here. We're coming up at 2 hours, but we covered a whole lot, and I think we did it well. It's a very complex topic. It gets into theology, geopolitics, revisionist history, and kind of having to reconsider a lot of what we've been told our entire lives of what's been going on in this world. Again, it's Destabilization, Directed Discontent in Egypt and Beyond. You can read that at conspiracyarchives.com. Paul and Philip Collins, your book is The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, An Examination of the Epistemic Autocracy. And your new book, I imagine it's probably as in-depth as the other one. So when does it due out? Like 10 years from now? When do you get this thing done?
We've been talking about it forever. We're up to 351 pages now with the current draft.
Yeah. Okay.
All I can tell you is the main title is going to be Invoking the Beyond. I don't know about the subtitle just yet. Our hopes is sometime next year. We're starting to plow through it, and that's what we're hoping to do. We're hoping to get it out then.
Have you a chance of releasing like a paperback graphic novel form to appeal to the masses?
not really.
Okay.
Slim and none.
Didn't the 9/11 Commission do that with their comic book version? I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, I think there was a comic book version out of it. So geekdom had their perception properly.
We'll be promoting at Comic Cons. you want to do a Collins brother cosplay? Feel free. We're twins, so you won't have to work very hard. You just dress alike.
Oh yes, we like the prestige.
Yeah, there you go.
Listen, well, thank you for coming out. Listen, we got to do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
I think we addressed the dozens of issues that warrant their own show here.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
We'll narrow in on something again in the near future. Talk about something. So I'll let you tend to your dog there.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks a lot and good night.
Thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.